All right, Jay, if you could go ahead and say your name and spell your last name.
My name is Jay Hathaway. Last name is spelled Hathewey. First name is Jay.
Thank you. And my name is Troy Reeves, and I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program, and we're interviewing Jay over the phone about his time here in Madison, specifically regarding LGBT issues. So, Jay, the first question I want to ask, and this might require you to go back in time a little bit, is ask how you ended up at UW. So if you want to start with that, and we'll go from there.
Sure. I ended up at UW some 33 years ago now, back in 1979. After I had contacted Dr. George Mossy, where I was living at the time, which was in Monterey, California. And while I was in Monterey, California, I was pursuing a master's degree in international studies in German language with an emphasis in this instance, quite frankly, on the Nazis and German history. And I had read a couple of texts by George Mossy, and it was recommended to me by my advisors back in the day that I might consider pursuing a PhD, really did enjoy what I was doing. And the experience of contacting Mossy was all done by letter, and he in turn then sent me an application. He was very positive about my becoming a graduate student here. At the time, he said he probably would not be my advisor specifically because of the emphasis upon the Schutzstaffel SS, and that would be to Bob Kahle. The larger reason I was out here, the background behind my even graduate school in Monterey, California, at the Monterey Institute of International Studies, is that I was waiting out an appeals process that was going to be working its way through the military appeals courts for my court-martial for violation of Article 125 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. That's the sodomy statute. And I had been subjected to a court-martial in 1975 and 1976 while I lived in Germany. I was subsequently found guilty and given a discharge under less than honorable conditions and assigned to a particular battalion in Fort Ord, California, where I was put on administrative leave, essentially, while the appeals courts were gone through. And during that period of waiting is when I enrolled at the Monterey Institute. So that's sort of a full circle of how we got here.
Thank you. So Jay, and I know you've written about this, but when did all the appeals process become final? Was that after you got to UW or was that before?
Actually, after I got to UW, the appeals process went through the military appeals court system. And I think the last of those was a court of military appeals. And I'm not sure where that was located, but presumably Washington, D.C. At that point, then, my attorneys, who were with the American Civil Liberties Union and Lawyers Military Defense Committee, a subunit of the ACLU, then began the process of going into the federal courts. And the long and short of that is, in 1981 or 1982, when I was at UW, the United States Supreme Court refused to hear our case, and that was the absolute end of our upset. We just stopped, nowhere to go after that. Except, of course, legislation, but nobody wanted to hear the story at the time.
Okay. Thank you for that, too. So, had you been to Madison, Wisconsin, before you arrived here as a graduate student?
No, as a matter of fact, when I was in California, in Monterey, I had this vision of Madison being something like 2.5 million people. I've ridden through Wisconsin before, but not through Madison. So when I drove out from California in a slow, arduous trek, as it was, when I got to Madison, I remember kept telling myself, well, there's no there there. Where are these 3 million people? So the answer is no. And so the humorous is obviously Madison was 10 times smaller than I had imagined it to be.
Mm-hmm. So where did you have any connections in the LGBT community or anything like that before you came here?
None whatsoever. I was fundamentally unaware of at the time belonged to Rodney Shield called Rods, I think it was called. Yeah, it was Rods. And this was within days of my arriving in July of 1979. And I did it because I just wanted to go and see what gay life was like here in Madison. And it was when I went to Rodney's back in July of 79, I just ran into people. We started talking, oh, new face, who are you, what are you doing? And then I ran into people who were involved with the gay newspaper here in town. I just forget what it's called. It might have been called Out. And there was a gay, United is what it was called, yes, the United. And I became really interested, perhaps, in doing what I could, because I was so angry and burned from the experience of the military, and I wanted to get involved with gay men and gay women who were doing things to make, I suppose we could say, things right. And literally from the get-go, so that would have been at the end of 79, then I simply became a member of the United, the organization which existed on the old Methodist Church on University, not too far from campus. And by the by, within 2 years, I think, I was their education director. We had received a grant. We had received a grant, and it was my job then to, I suppose, lead the charge in getting the word out about the services of the United and working with gay men and gay women. So that's been my entree to the sort of the LBG community here in Madison back in 79.
Okay. And I'm not sure of the history. Was it the United that published Out, or was Out published separately from?
Out was published, I do believe, by Out.
Okay.
They were separate. What would happen is I would do my business with, and I was still a graduate student, so this is sort of on the side, I would do my business with the United and met all the good folk who were there. And by the by, in the early 80s perhaps, I remember that the newspaper, fundamentally, it was open for people who wanted to volunteer and participate, and then there was a small paid position for advertising and editing. I thought, okay, so I just threw my 2 cents in, and then no one else wanted it, so I took it. So I ended up editing and doing advertising, soliciting and building ads, and actually writing articles for Out. It was an enjoyable experience. I learned quite a bit about the politics, if you will, of the gay community in Madison through that rather small part-time job.
Okay. So I think there's going to be two currents running through at least this session. Your educational experience in Madison and your LGBT experience in Madison. I do want to ask one more question about LGBT before I go back and talk to you about your academics. And that's, do you recall some of the first people that you met, those either, you know, first few weeks, months, or maybe even the first couple of years that either you befriended or they befriended you?
I do. The two people who stick out the most is John Meese. John Meese is now deceased, and he was a very dedicated intake worker, if you will, volunteer. He was a professor of biology at UW, and he and I became friends, actually. And he's, from my perspective, in the day, he was much older than I, by about 30 years. And he was a very gentle soul who worked to assuage, basically, answer phones. was a graduate student at the same time I was a graduate student. So our paths would cross, and it would cross in the context of giving presentations to students at UW or sometimes even high schools, as I remember, but the ones in the college environment stick to my mind the most, that we would begin to talk about issues, and the legal issue that was foremost at the point when I first met her was the issue of gays in the military. And I think she would talk about gays as well in the context of civil rights in Wisconsin. I don't know for a fact, but I think that this was all a buildup from Tammy's position, working with David Clarenbaugh to have the non-discrimination statutes of 1982. So it's all about the same time, 1979 and 1980. So one was, again, those two guys, John Neese and Tony Mason, with United, and then because of my education outreach with United, and people just wanted to know about the gays in the military thing, people began to talk about it. The other person was David Runyon, who was really important in that regard. David was sort of like a bit of a cheerleader for me. And then by 1981, I began to meet additional people to this core of Runyon, John Neese, and on and off Tammy, because we cross all the time at UW.
Okay. Since it was, I guess we can consider in your early years here at UW, the non-discriminatory legislation, which just actually met its 30th anniversary earlier this summer, I want to ask what involvement you had in that.
Okay. That was a complete State Assembly and State Senate affair. I remember that I would talk in support of it when I was asked, but of course that was really the David Clarenbaugh's baby, and all kudos to him for that activity, and Tammy Baldwin, the legie and the lawyer, so to speak. So I had really nothing to do with that except, of course, support it publicly whenever I could, which was limited to my education job at United and whatever small educational talks I would give from time to time.
Okay. And you also said early on in your work for the United, they received a large grant?
More than a large grant, but it was a grant sufficient to fund my position, and it came from an organization which was in the day, now I can't remember the name, Lambda something, it was in Chicago, actually, and it was a possible refundable, $5,900, and I think the second one was for about $9,600. And I seem to recall that one of the people who worked on that in the day was Kathleen Nichols as well. She was very involved, a lot of women's issues, but she was very involved early on, along with Tammy Baldwin, because during this very early period, I also got involved in a grant that Tammy Baldwin had managed to wing, working with to develop in services for high school teachers and counselors to make them more aware of basically the presence of gays as lesbians in high school. And I think Tammy might have been at the time, she was on one level of government. I don't remember if it was the State Assembly at the time or previous to the State Assembly at this point.
Okay. All right. So this grant—it was a two-year grant that funded your position at United. Okay. All right. So let's back up a little bit and talk about your early academic career at UW-Madison. How did you feel in those early days, early weeks, as you started taking classes? How did you feel you stacked up against some of the other graduate students, and also how you felt your professors were?
Well, that's a good question. I initially felt underprepared. I wasn't quite really advised at how competitive UW could be. I did not know, for example, when I joined, if you will, when I was hired by Bob Carroll to be his like it. I didn't like that aspect of it. It was a bit of I'm smarter than you. For my benefit, though, fortunately, Bob Carroll and George Massey, because I was older, I was ex-military, and I was already 29 going on to 30, and the rest of the crew were about 6-7 years younger, right out of college. They saw that I was a little distressed by it, so I began to talk with them, and no word of advice was just put up with it, because that's the way some of these people are. They're little professors, they think, and more power to you. As it turned out, I was one of the few people in the actual cohort to finish the PhD with a dissertation. So over the course of year one, year two, year three, my apprehensions were assuaged because I began to understand how this competitive process worked, and quite frankly, I began to thrive. And as it turned out, I did maintain my 4.0, and I had wonderful experiences with George Massey and Harvey Goldberg, Sterling Fishman, and Domenico Sella, going back to the day, and Bob Kale, and Jim Stakely, who as a gay man at the time was also very instrumental, sort of getting me intellectually oriented towards, in this case, the rise of the gay rights movement in Germany. And then, of course, George Massey and his work got me in tune with that as well. And I was, in a sense, sort of in hog heaven, such that after 3 years, as I had completed the stages of my PhD program, I was about the top of the academic heap, and then was able to become a teaching assistant based upon my GPA and my language qualifications, passing all those. And then I passed my my written examinations, and then whammo, there I was, literally at the top. So I never suffered from a fear that I would not be able to be a TA, which back in the day is something I really wanted because I was paying out-of-state tuition from California, which even then was high. And it worked out really well. I began to work with Massey and all these other good folk at UW who began to share with me a lot of their intellectual traditions. And I have to admit, the people who influenced me the most are Bob Kale, George Massey, and Harvey Goldberg. Those three were really influential in shaping my understanding of history. And in particular, because this was reflected later in one of my other books, in particular, a unique, at least from my perspective back then, understanding how one goes about the business of being an historian, and a form of historiography that is uniquely German and uniquely University of Wisconsin-Madison because of its German roots. And that particular methodology in historiography is related to the concepts of historicism and contextuality, that you understand the past not in terms of the present, but in terms of the events and the context in which they took place. And that's sort of controversial with some people. I'm not quite sure why. In some of my writings, in particular, one book I wrote on homophobia, I was trashed for that approach. And my only comment to myself was, well, okay, fine, whatever. But it was really valuable. It really shaped me. And it was a very positive experience. I had some negative experiences, some pretty profound ones, but it wasn't with the faculty with whom I associated. I really enjoyed all of them, even as some of them were difficult. But one aside, I took one course that I probably should not have. And the damn thing was in Latin. Tell me, how many times do you have a course in medieval European history in Latin? And I didn't know Latin, so that was a challenge and a half. That was Robert Kingdom. I don't know if you know him.
Mm-mm. No.
His specialty was Reformation church history and Renaissance church history. Oh, boy. The damn thing was in the Washburn Observatory, and his office was the bottom floor. It was all paneled and all in Latin. And when I walked in, all these guys were just going on and on and on, and I said, what on earth am I doing here? I was advised to take the course, the biggest mistake. I got an A out of it, but... Professor my argument was that the Schutzstaffel were but another manifestation of the Western emphasis towards perfection and progress. Now, of course, people say, how can this be perfection and progress? Well, you talk to a Nazi, and they're going to talk to you about how perfect and progressive the movement is, and that's what my dissertation was all about. That was difficult. Trying to read old German texts and trying to convince my dissertation readers and all this other stuff, it was challenging. I'm glad I don't have to do that again.
Now, was that when in the how early on in the process did you come to that as your dissertation topic?
It was actually sort of late, because when I came here from California, I was initially going to do my dissertation on the SS and sports. The problem was that after rummaging around in archives and all sorts, we couldn't find too much on sports at the time. Now we can find a lot of it, as it turns out, was captured by the Soviets, went to Russian archives. But back in the 70s and 80s, there wasn't as much to talk about. So the subtle shift in the topic from sports to the notion of SS perfection, probably around 83 years into the program here, it really wasn't so difficult intellectually, because the purpose of sports was to create a more perfect Aryan type. But that was hard to find. But it wasn't as difficult to find propaganda on just the SS as a more perfect Aryan period without the sports, just the whole notion of it. So I'd say maybe 3 years into it, I just said, let's just drop the whole thing about sports, and let's just go on into the notion of perfection, which is the title of my dissertation is something like Search for Perfection or something for the SS. So, a couple of years, yeah.
Jay, to do this dissertation, do the research on this dissertation, how much could you do here at UW-Madison? How much required you to go to Germany?
I could do all of it here. I did all of it here. But it wasn't exactly as if I hadn't been to Germany, because I lived in Germany for 6 years. Almost six. And I had done stuff previous to coming back to the States. I didn't know what I was going to do with this material. I had tons of stuff that I had accumulated by visiting various museums and archives when I was in uniform. And I did so because when I lived in Germany, I was living in post, a location that during World War II and before was the SS Officers Military Academy. And that absolutely caught my imagination. I knew nothing about World War II when I moved there as a young man. I knew nothing about the SS really, and over the course of my years there, I got to know SS people, got to look at archives, got to get photos. I met SS and all sorts of stuff. So by the time I came to Monterey, before I came out here, I had piles, and indeed my master's essay was on the SS Education Academy. And when I was writing my master's essay, I had the benefit of being befriended by the former SS commandant, who sent me tons of information and then guided me when I was in Monterey, California, to where the archives were all of his notes and all of the other instructors were located from the 30s and 40s. And consequently, I was able to contact them over the course of several years, and I have absolutely boxes and boxes of stuff that I brought back with me, and I was able to get here in the States. And when I ended up at Madison then with all this information, in addition to what we had had here through Bob Hill and George Mossy up in our archives, it was actually pretty good. I didn't have to go anywhere. All the major research, surprisingly, had already been done, although I didn't know it at the time. It was Mossy and Kale who said, well, let's organize this stuff in a meaningful way, and you'll see that you already have more research done than most people in a dissertation ever do. And it facilitated then the process, quite frankly. I was lucky. I stumbled into it, I suppose that's what you would say.
Yeah, that's fascinating that the work you did while in uniform, while it wasn't officially, you know, historical work, ended up being a boon to your dissertation.
And it's still, I still have it in files and folders and
This is a bit off the track, but it's not really because it's about your research and your time here. You said you were guided by an SS commandant. Did you meet him while in Germany, while in the military, or was this something that happened after you came back here?
I met him while I was in Germany, very briefly. And then the relationship sort of blossomed after I came back to the States. Now, where I lived in Germany was a place called Bad Tölz, and this is where Heinrich Himmler, head of the SS, he lived in the vicinity. He had a house pretty close by. Heinrich Himmler, head of SS, was from Munich, an old Munich family. And so when he wanted to educate his officer corps, he chose this little town not so far from his own home, his own family home, and Munich, where, again, he grew up. And this post, then, was captured by the Americans after World War II. It was George Patton who captured the post. What was your question again?
It was the SS commandant. How did the sort of the backstory of...
Yeah, so when I was in Bad Tölz, there were a lot of former members of the SS who still lived in Bad Tölz when I moved there in the early 70s. They had just never left the town. And over the course of my experience, I ended up stumbling into the SS bar. Imagine, an SS bar. Who knew? And I remember sitting down, it was actually sort of humorous, and they asked me where I was. I was an American, I didn't know it was SS, and I said, I can't tell you. Imagine a young man, an American, walking into a bar in Germany, a small town, there's only one post American, I have, my head is shaved like a Marine, and I can't tell them where I'm from. And they laughed and said, oh, you're obviously from the old SS post. And I said, oh, really? I didn't actually know that. And that began this conversation that lasted a couple of years. And into this mixture was when I met this guy. His name is Sir Richard Schulze-Colson. And Richard Schulze-Colson was not only the commandant of the school for a while. I mean, there were many commandants. His tenure was about 2 years. The post was operational by 36, shut down in 45. But Schulze-Colson also went on to become Adolf Hitler's military adjutant and followed him when he went all different locations. And Mr. Schulze-Colson was also part of the delegation that went to Moscow for the German-Russian Non-Aggression Pact of 1939. And Schulze-Colson, when I was back in the States, sent me all of these photographs of him with Hitler, him with Mussolini, him with the Russians, and all this. And it was fascinating as a witness to history. He was eventually, after the war, captured, he was tried, he was sent to prison, and he ended up working for a Volkswagen company as sort of a foreman. And he became one of the post-World War II leaders, if you will, in the retired members of the Waffen-SS, an organization that attempted to lobby to have the SS members' civil rights restored. I wasn't in a position where I was going to attack guys, and it may seem odd, but when I would go to the bar and listen to them, I would simply listen and record. I wanted them to tell me everything. I didn't want to sit there and say, screw you, you're a monster. My position on the SS is that it's an organization which is monstrous, but I wasn't there at that moment to have them shut up on me. The more I got to know them, the more honest they were, and the more frightening the stories that they told me. And over the 3 years, I got to know dozens of these guys, some of whom I think committed horrendous crimes, but they spent their time in prison. They did their business. Bad Tölz itself, during the war years, was a subcamp of Dachau. And I remember asking these guys, so how could you... And, of course, they would go on and on about the Jews this and the Jews that. Unrepentant. Very briefly, I'll give you the story. One story, a very brief one. One of the guys who was at the bar that I used to go to was going on and on about how all the Western press was lying about the murder of the Jews. And he says, ah, that didn't happen. We didn't murder 3 million Jews or 6 million Jews. 1 million maybe, but not 6 million. This is their mentality. And I wanted to hear it. It was important to me to understand where they were coming from, understand what it was all about, understand the nature of the organization. And for a kid from regular middle-class American background to be introduced in my early 20s to this sort of stuff. It was a real eye-opener, a real eye-opener. My dissertation followed up on much of what these guys were telling me from their perspective. This is how they looked at the world. This is what they saw. And again, the whole goal was to understand why they did what they did. And this is where people like Masi helped me understand German historiography, put myself in their shoes so I could better understand the decisions they made. And to this day, I suppose I'm one of the few people, Bob Campbell and I sort of laugh about, the SS is considered antiquarian, not too many people really study it anymore. But I have a really solid understanding of what their mentality was, where they came from, what they hoped to have done, why they did what they did. And none of it, of course, is a pretty picture. But that sort of rounds out how I ran into Schutzenkosen in the first place. And then after here, he would send me stuff just to send me stuff. I think I don't really know too much why he took a liking to me. But I never saw him again, quite frankly, after Germany. And then eventually he passed away, I think, 20 years ago, I think, maybe something like that.
Okay. I think via email I'll have you spell some of these names for me. I don't want to take up the time on the recording, but I want to get the spellings correct. So now I want to sort of change gears completely to something you mentioned earlier in the interview, and that was wanting to be a TA. And so I want to ask you a little bit about that, because I know there was a TA strike in 1980, and I'm not sure whether you were a TA at that point or not, but maybe just sort of generally ask about why you became interested in being a TA, and maybe some of the people, other TAs that you met during those first few years you were here.
I was not a TA in 1980. I remember the strike really just vaguely, and I'm not exactly sure the nature of the issues. It was something to do with either working conditions or time spent, and I think it was overpay, basically. I was just too busy doing graduate work, and I wasn't even a member of the TAA or anything like that. I was too busy doing my stuff. But I do recall that about 82 or so, that Bob Kale had mentioned to me that I might consider becoming a TA. I hadn't really thought about it. And he told me the advantages from my perspective. It was from where I was in the day, it was good pay, you get health insurance, and you get to learn a little bit about what it's like teaching in the classroom. And that was an appeal to me, the aspect of teaching, the aspect of health care, the aspect of some salary coming in. I mean, that was a really good thing. And again, I was paying out-of-state tuition. It was expensive, and this would offset some of that. So my interest in being a TA was, on the one hand, both academic and money-wise. I needed the money. And there was a degree of prestige, as I seem to recall, too. Not everybody in the graduate school was a TA. There was a list of people that was prominently placed somewhere in the history department. And it looked like people who were on that list were sort of the in people at the graduate school. I wanted to be an in person at the graduate school after being out in the military. I wanted something that seemed sort of good to my name. And all of that stuff came together, and again, it was Masi and Kale who said, irrespective of all that stuff, we could use you because we like the way you do your work. And so, at their pushing, and mostly at Bob Kale's pushing, I really applied myself to get on that list, and the list was prioritized by what we refer to as Harrison points. Are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not.
The Harrison points is a scale that is used if you've finished your coursework, if you've finished your languages, if you've finished your orals, if you're a dissertator, and each one of those steps along the way, you get a Harrison point. And when you get to 12 Harrison points, then you are finally able to get on the list to be a TA. But then it goes by GPA. And if it gets really bad, they'll even go into your college GPA to figure out. So the GPAs, the level of GPA that was chosen to be TAs ranked from 4.0 to 3.99999, and that was it. Everybody below that, forget about it, you'll never all the Harrison points, but your GPA was 3.75, you would never become a TA because you're 40th on the list. And I always managed to be in the top 10.
Okay. Okay, so that was later on, sorry, in your period here on campus.
It was probably about 87, maybe. Okay. And that began to occur. Yeah. What's it going to be, Mr. Hathaway? You're going to be a graduate student, you're going to be a damn gay activist. Get your act together. One of the two, but not both. It was pretty funny. I was scared to death, but now I'm thinking about it, it's pretty funny.
So do you recall, I mean, you said it learned, you learned it wasn't glamorous, you learned humility. What did you learn about yourself as a teacher?
I learned that I enjoyed it a lot. I learned that going into a classroom, assuming you know everything, is it'll kill you in a heartbeat. And I learned that if you don't know something, fine. Live with it. Be comfortable. And if you don't know something, be honest. So I learned that teaching is a process that involves more to the point. It's a holistic process that involves both students and faculty, in this case me, and that in order to, I think, be an effective teacher or professor in this case, you learn from your students as much, hopefully, as they learn from you. And you're in it together as essentially a team. Now, under ideal conditions, that's the best way to be, sort of a give and take back and forth. I do some work, you do some work, I give some talk, you give some talk, I give ideas, you give ideas, and we go back and forth collectively. It's not master going in and hitting the head, kids over the head with a crowbar and saying, I'm the king of the hill and you're not. Now, when I started, I didn't even know. Of course, I'd been in class before, but I hadn't even thought about it from the perspective of one who's going to be imparting knowledge. And so the humility comes into the fact that, oh my God, I really don't know what I'm talking about, do I? And I had to really face that one in front of 40, 50 kids, students, and do so in a way that didn't literally have them laughing me out the door. And the way I learned about that was to say who I was, what I was doing, and the limits of what I knew, and perhaps if you ask a question, I don't know, perhaps we can work it out together and let's see where it takes. So that took me a while to figure out. I had a background from my undergraduate school in California called Claremont McKenna College, where the professors literally were gods, and you didn't challenge what the gods said. And although UW was significantly different than that, the idea that professors were gods was still sort of in the back of my head. I mean, if you'd known George Mossy, he was as friendly as you could be, but literally when So that's what TA did. It allowed me to confirm that I wanted to be a teacher and taught me, I think, some of the immediate concerns that I should take into account, sensibility of students, the lack of my depth of information and knowledge and stuff. So that's the direction I was moving.
Thank you. I want to ask one more thing, and then I think I want to wrap it up for today. And it's still on the topic of TAs. I asked you who were your initial friends or cohorts when you got here to Madison. I'm wondering, as you became a TA, did you find people that you befriended or people who befriended you?
Actually, no. Not as a TA. There were so few of us, and each of us were in different fields. Now, we talked as TAs because we shared offices. We would talk amongst ourselves. This is true. But none of them, we weren't friends. We were all pretty quirky personalities, to be honest with you. some TAs were really stuck up. I'm a TA, I'm better than them. Some TAs were the quiet as a church mouse, wouldn't say a word even if you were in their face and cried, no. And the subjects were very different. So everybody was pretty much in their own cocoon, I would say. With respect to learning how to be a TA, oddly enough, perhaps, Bob Kill, my immediate academic mentor, was the one who taught me the most about what it was to be a TA, primarily because he was working with me on what not to do. There were certain things that he liked, certain things he didn't like. And when I would make what he thought were poor judgments on things, he would let me know about it and say, let's do this over again. Here's what you do. So he was the person who got me on the straight and narrow for TA. And the other kids were, again, everyone was sort of cocooned, so no, I didn't really know. To this day, I don't know. One person, his name was Bruce Campbell. He and I were probably the closest because he also did German stuff. But even then, he and I weren't too close, actually. So, yeah, that's about what it was.
Okay. Jay, as I said, I want to wrap this up for today, but I want you to have the last word. So is there anything, now that we've been talking for about 45 minutes about these early years, you know, the first 2, 3, 4, 5 years in Madison, that may be on your mind now that you'd like to get on the record and before we shut it down for the day?
I guess one thing that I haven't mentioned is that during this period, I had two events that sort of traumatized me. One was my mother became very ill and would die in September of 1983, almost 30 years ago, from lung cancer. And that was a major interruption in my program at UW, such that I wasn't even sure if I was going to come back to complete the program. I had to leave at the beginning of the semester, as it is right now. She died on the 12th of September of 1983, and I had to leave, and I couldn't return. I had to take the whole semester off. And that was created ambiguities to whether it would come back. And the other issue that I was going through was, sad to say, I was drinking too much. I was drinking way too much, and I got a series of traffic tickets that threw me in jail. And I look back on it, it was 30 years ago. I'm pretty sure I know what was going on. It was a function of my court-martial and a function of the weight as I perceived it in the day of everything going south. Nothing was right. Everything seemed to be going wrong. Now, I look back and I think, what a moron I was. But in the day, I was having problems. I couldn't keep jobs when I was in California. I kept being fired because they said that I was unsuitable for hiring because I was immoral, and they made reference to my court-martial. In these jobs, when I was in graduate school, I kept saying, no, you can't work, you're fired. And then my school in California threatened to withdraw its master's, my master's degree, using moral turpitude as a reason. So the students at the school got behind me. I was unaware that they got behind me when they found out. And the Board of Trustees of Monterey Institute backed down from withdrawing it. And then when I got here to Wisconsin, I was aware by 83 that the graduate school dean was beginning to really question whether or not he wanted me to participate in the graduate school. He didn't know that I was drinking, but I was drinking as a consequence of all this stuff. So
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for that. And as I said, I want to wrap it up for today. And I'll be in touch via email about scheduling a follow-up. And if you don't mind, this early morning, at least it's early for me, is a good time. So I hope this will be a good time for you for the follow-up.
Me, if it's okay for you.
Okay. Great. Well, Jay, I want to thank you for your time today. And as I said, I'll be in touch via email to set up the next session.
All right, then. Have a nice afternoon and a good weekend.
Yeah, you too, Jay. We'll talk to you later.
Okay, then.
Bye.